I call the meeting of the House of Higher Education Finance and Policy Division to order. And there is a quorum present. And may I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 26, 2019?
So moved.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Wolgamott, who has made a motion to approve the minutes for March 26, 2019. Is there any discussion? Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 26, 2019 have been approved. We have with us today Minnesota State and the University of Minnesota, who will be going over their budget recommendations with us. We thank you for coming, and we will start with Minnesota State. So, Vice Chancellor King, is this your last hurrah with our committee, or are you retiring?
No. Madam Chair, I am.
And was I not supposed to say that? I'm not sure.
Oh, it's public.
Okay, that's fine. I was like, oh my gosh.
It's known.
Not that I've said it on television.
There will be parties all over the place to celebrate my departure.
Well, best wishes to you. And when is that?
End of June.
Okay, so you'll be with us whole session. Well, welcome to our committee. And we're here to discuss the updated version of the governor's budget request and answer any questions members may have about the budget, which is not actually, we're not talking about the governor's budget. Well, he's not here anyway, but that was in the notes. We have with us Vice Chancellor of Finance, Laura King, to go more in-depth into the Minnesota State budget. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon to members. My name is Laura King, and I'm the Vice Chancellor for Finance and Chief Financial Officer for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Delighted to be here with you today on this beautiful day that helps us forget the winter we just had. It's out of our minds now. I'm here, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for an opportunity to start first by thanking you and your colleagues for your strong targets. We were delighted to see the higher education targets. We know that there are competing interests. Appreciate your leadership on behalf of the higher education community and look forward to our work in the coming month as we proceed to the end of session. We also appreciate the time the committee has spent this past month allowing us an opportunity to provide an overview of our system and of our budget request. As Chancellor Mahotra testified, our colleges and universities educate almost 60% of all undergraduates in Minnesota. We served 244,000 students this past year, 60% of whom reside outside the metropolitan area. We provide opportunity and access at 54 campuses across Minnesota, and each of these campuses provides opportunity, access, and in many cases represent the only higher education provider available to them in their region. We educate 65,800 students of color and American Indian students, 43,900 first-generation college students, 80,000 students 25 years or older, 10,000 veterans and service members, and nearly 76,000 low-income students. The governor's budget, as was presented with his revisions last week, does not cover the cost of our budget request or the cost of a tuition freeze. His recommendation did include $8 million for our ERP replacement, and while our request there was substantially higher, we appreciate his recognition of this important work. His recommendation also included $57 million in campus support. I do want to extend our appreciation for his recognition in the revised budget. We're nowhere near the level of support we were hoping, but it's clear to us that the governor made reductions in other areas in order to secure more resources for our campuses. And for that sign of support, we are grateful. We're also grateful to the commissioner and his staff and the staff at MMB for their willingness to engage with us as they develop their supplemental budget recommendations. You will find in your packet information that will give you a sense of the revenue relationship in our tuition approach. As we shared with you last month, our colleges and universities are highly dependent on state support. It represents 49% of our general fund revenue, with tuition representing the other 51%. Fully half of our revenue for teaching and student services comes from you. With your help, over the past 6 years, we have been able to avoid or hold down tuition increases. Because we have only two sources of revenue, an unfunded tuition freeze represents budget cuts for our colleges and universities. Campuses need resources to protect the quality of our programs, ensure students have course availability, and support systems they need to succeed. We know that the question of tuition intention is on your minds. I can't give you an exact response on our approach to tuition for several reasons. We think it's important for the committee to know that our board has a very strong commitment to consultation, consultation with our student community, with our faculty and staff community, with our campus leadership, before any contemplation of a tuition recommendation. And that consultation can't happen until we pin down the outlook for the state support. So it's a pretty tightly woven formula. They will seek to balance our commitment to campus decision-making and unique challenges with the board's commitment to access and affordability. Madam Chair, I also want to thank you and your committee members for your work. I'm confident that there's great clarity on the importance of the work that happens at our colleges and universities, and I also know that you and your members understand the importance of our institutions and the communities they serve. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do members have questions? We have Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Vice Chancellor King. I represent the St. Cloud State University community and St. Cloud Technical Community College. And I'm really grateful to the faculty and staff that work at those institutions. They really are the cutting edge, I think, of what makes us competitive as a state, the instruction and the time they put into their teaching. So I just would like for you to speak about how much of this budget request will go to supporting staff and faculty and how that can improve the wages and benefits for staff and faculty.
Madam Chair and Representative, I'd be happy to. Our budget request and what the governor supported really had two elements. The first element we label campus support, and the resources in that part of the budget all go out to the campuses. And we would expect that they would all be used for salary negotiations and for paying the cost of operating expenses that go up from year to year. There's nothing in the campus support provision that stays in St. Paul to do something in St. Paul. It all goes out to the campuses. So whatever this committee is able to do in that column is benefit to all of the colleges and universities. We also have in the next gen proposal, we would view that as also being entirely to the benefit of the campuses, because the campuses are the ones that use the record system. They register the students, they issue transcripts, they award financial aid, they record grades. All of that happens in the record system, and that all happens on the campuses.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Vice Chancellor King. So when you are receiving significantly less, according, I mean, if we follow the governor's budget, right, $65 million, and you have a request of $246 million. How do you set your priorities? How do you go about, I mean, do you just eliminate the grant programs? How do you set your priorities for what will be funded?
Madam Chair, Representative, it would start with what the bill says the resources are available for. And so part of that is in your hands. If the final appropriation bill gives us guidance on how the new resources are desired to be spent, then we would follow that guidance. The budget request before you really is our priorities. It's support for the ERP, support for campus operating costs, There was not support from the governor for the workforce program, and he approached the grant program through his Office of Higher Ed recommendations. So it would depend on what the final bill told us. Fundamentally, if our resources aren't sufficient, then we're cutting programs. We're closing programs. We're eliminating staff lines. We're slowing down our repair and replacement investments. We're making the kinds of reallocation choices our campuses have made every year as long as Representative Nornes and I have been doing the higher ed budget. As we shared with you earlier this month, we average about $35 million a year in reallocations where campuses take something from an investment line that they decide they don't want to do anymore or they can't afford to do. And over the last 4 or 5 years, we've reallocated about $150 million. So the campuses, regrettably, have gotten pretty good at dialing budgets back as resources have been limited. But it has direct effect to what programs can they offer, how do they serve their communities, what is the health of their relationship with business and industry. It all flows back to their ability to do those things.
Okay. Just a follow-up question, Madam Chair and Vice Chancellor. So what percentage of your costs of operation are the employees? It's about 85%?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's about 75% across the whole operation. In our general fund, where we have all of the teaching and learning expenses, it's closer to 80. But once you bring in our residential life programs, our parking programs, our food service programs, the number comes down a little bit. So on average, it's about 75% overall.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Vice Chancellor King, I heard you say that the money will go to campuses. Right. So as
the money will go to campuses.
I just have a question. I know that in the past it has been sometimes the situation where the system office will do something that then requests money from campuses to be able to pay for something or support something. And I just want to make it clear then, so this money is to go to campuses, but there's not going to be any clawback or any expectation that any money is going to come back to the system office after the campuses receive their money.
Madam Chair, Representative Poppy, it's too early for me to know how to answer that question. We have a planning process with our presidents that happens every year, and presidents identify things they want us to do more of, things they want us to do less of. You'll recall that the appropriation to the system office has been frozen since 2012. So to the extent there's interest from the campuses in more services, then we have to talk to the campuses about how to pay for those services. So I can't make any representations at this point because we're too far away from the budget planning process.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Vice Chancellor King. I guess to speak to that a little bit further, you know, the campuses are where the money is made. Because the students are the ones that are bringing in the tuition dollars, and they are the ones and their own money that they're paying for, and that's where the faculty and staff are supporting the enterprise, because that's how the system works. So just, you know, maybe I know that sometimes the presidents may be thinking about things that they want, but we need to be mindful that the work gets done on the campus level and as much as possible to avoid trying to get it so that the money flows out of the campuses again when the work gets done at the campus level. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It'll come to you as no surprise that I'm going to ask about the state grant program.
Okay.
So I'm curious, in looking at the documents and seeing how everything is broken out in our booklet by the individual campuses, I'm just wondering, collectively, how much of your revenue actually comes from state grants?
Madam Chair, Representative Cleburne, I don't know the answer to that. I do know that state and federal grants combined, about 60% of our students receive one or both a state and federal grant. I can tell you that. And I know that overall, if I'm recalling the number right, about $400 million in financial aid is embedded in our tuition revenue. But I can't tell you offhand. We can certainly get you that number, but I can't break out for you the portion that's from the state versus the federal.
I would be interested in that. Excuse me, Madam
Chair. I'll count on my colleagues to make a note so that I remember to come back to you with it.
And may I ask one more follow-up? I'm curious then, with the governor's proposal for the increase in that state grant program, how do you think that will impact your revenue and budget planning process?
Vice Chancellor King.
Madam Chair, Representative, it works a couple of different ways. It depends on whether it's an increase in the amount of the state grant versus an increase in the living and maintenance allowance.
Mm-hmm.
And then you need to make some assumptions about whether the increase in the state grant is going to generate a new student or provide assistance to an existing student. Mm-hmm. I know that the Office of Higher Ed has done that modeling, and we can track down their conclusions, but we would rely on their modeling for the students that participate in the state grant program. For our students, to the extent we have students that are fully state grant eligible, it would advantage the current students with a larger grant. And, of course, all of the students are advantaged by the living and maintenance allowance increase.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps, I don't know if you referenced enrollment, but could you just speak to enrollment and the trend, and is that part of, is the governor responding at all to the fact that there is perhaps lower enrollment?
Vice Chancellor King.
Certainly, Madam Chair and Representative Runbeck. Our enrollment has been an interesting journey for us. For those that are long familiar with the public higher education system, it's very predictable that two-year college enrollment will move in relation to the unemployment rate. And we saw that as the economy was slowing down in the early part of this decade. Our overall enrollment went up about 17%, and we did not come to you with a request for support to help pay those costs, and we did not come to the governor. And, of course, there's nothing in the state funding formula that's tied to enrollment. So as our enrollment surged in the 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12 horizon, our campuses managed that expansion with existing resources. And likewise, as our enrollment has come back down, as the unemployment rate has gone down and folks have gone back to work, we have not asked the state to help us bridge that loss in revenue, nor did we ask the governor. So there's nothing in our budget request that seeks assistance to help our campuses with the revenue losses they've experienced with enrollment decline. They have managed that with their own budget reduction exercises.
But, Madam Chair, so on the spending side of the budget, with fewer students, there would be less spending. What has been happening on that side? And if there are fewer students, won't there be fewer costs?
Vice Chancellor King.
Madam Chair, Representative Runbeck, if staff can find the materials we had with you when we provided the overview, there's a couple of slides in there that I would draw to your attention. One of them illustrates that I think since 2008, I believe, our spending adjusted for inflation has gone up on average about 0.1% a year. So the size of our budget is about the same as it was 10 years ago. Campuses, they pulsed for enrollment, and then they retracted. Over time, from our prior enrollment trough to our current enrollment position, our spending is flat, and the campuses have taken the spending out to balance their budgets. Costs do go down, absolutely. They don't go down in a straight line because you have one faculty for 20 or 25 students, and if you're down to 20 students, you're still got a faculty member. So it's a little lumpier than that, but they have gone down. and the campuses have managed that. We've also seen a substantial amount of program redesign, program closures, some new program additions. Overall, our headcount is down about 10% in the last 6 years, I think, 2012. So we have reduced staff as the enrollment numbers have gone down, and that has come out in the costs.
All right, thank you very much.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at what you've provided us here and utilizing some of the data in the book, between the 14-15 budget and what's being requested for the 2021 budget, the dollars per student in the request is up 230% increase from 367 to 841. I'm trying to understand why over two times the request per student, and you know, this would be the fourth budget that's on the sheet.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, it's really not apples to apples. The budget request you have in front of you for fiscal 20 and 21 has components in it that weren't in the 14-15 request. The 14-15 request, as I'm looking at it, was, as I recall, was substantially about inflation. What I don't remember is what we had in the 14-15 request for tuition. Our sort of cost of doing business inflation number is the same as it's been for probably six biennia. But we also have other things in this year's request that we didn't have in the request three cycles ago, most notably the ERP.
Madam Chair.
Representative Quam.
Thank you. Well, let's go back to is there stuff that's in the 2021 request that wasn't in the 18-19 request? Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, I wonder if it would be helpful for me to just take this offline and do a little side-by-side rather than do it here at the committee table. We can build a little comparative of what was in these old requests compared to what we have in this request.
Madam Chair,
Representative Quam.
The request actually, the increase by over 200%, you hit that just between 14-15 and 18-19. It'd be nice to understand where the huge bump, if there was something that wasn't, initiated, because when you're talking these quantities, it'd have to be something that was pretty substantial that kicked in those, 3 years, 4 years between those two budgets.
I appreciate that. I'm looking at the 14-15 number, and I see your point, and I can't explain it on its face. So I need to do a little staff work.
Okay, if you could get back to us, Vice Chancellor King, that would be very helpful.
Madam Chair,
Representative Quam.
Thank you, and I think I had, maybe it was the U of M I had queried about, but the 75% going to instruction and staff. What portion of that is actual classroom, instruction teacher to student?
Certainly, Madam Chair, Representative Quam, we do national reporting of all of our spending data by school into a national database that all of the providers in the country use. And the numbers are all put in under a set of agreed-upon rules about where costs are classified. And then we look at those results and we evaluate whether or not we have trends in our spending by type. We have been very intentional, as long as I've been around, to maintain the percentage of our budget that reports out as instruction and academic support. That tells us that we're dedicating resources to teaching and learning in the classroom, in the counseling centers, et cetera. And that number, as long as I've been watching it, has ranged from 63% to 66% of our spending. And that is up and down through enrollment levels and through sort of financial circumstances. So we pay attention to that. The 75% that I mentioned earlier, that's all of our staff. That's not just our teaching staff. If you take our entire budget and evaluate how much of the entire budget is spent on compensation, that number is 75%. The portion of our budget that's spent on instruction and academic support is about 65%.
Thank you.
Thank you. Excuse me, Representative Branson.
Thank you. Vice Chancellor King, I'm just going to kind of piggyback what some of my colleagues have said. So I'm looking at the salaries and benefits. Looks like in 2017 about $1.5 billion, almost $1.6 billion. Correct?
I don't know what you're looking at, but that number sounds right.
Okay. So I'm just wondering, that doesn't give us a good picture of exactly the breakdown of those that administrative costs, like the salary levels of what people are getting.
Madam Chair, Representative, you all got a copy of what we call the data book. It was a three-ring binder that we left you with. Yep. And if you keep digging in there, you will find a couple of tables that show you of our 17,000 employees, how many of them are faculty, how many of them are AFSCME, how many of them are MAPE. There's a table in there that describes all that for you.
If you look at Section 8 also. Section H, page one. Section H, page one. You can see where salary and benefits and it's expenditures by type based on functional area. I don't know.
So section eight. Okay.
Why is someone else talking for me? I thought I had the floor.
She was just finding the page for us that you requested.
Okay. That's what I'm going off
of. Oh, okay.
But anyway, what I'm asking for is a breakdown of the actual administration and what those salaries are. People back home are saying, well, what are we paying for? What's the salary? What's driving up the costs? And it's administration costs, but we have nothing. I can say, yeah, we're paying $1.6 billion in administration costs, but that doesn't really say.
Madam Chair, Representative
King,
costs are not going up. Our administrative spending is going down. If there's interest in administration, what's in administration, that's really a campus-by-campus question. If there's interest in the roster that gives you the salaries of 17,000 employees, that'll take a while. So I'm not quite sure how to get at the question. If the question is, what is our administrative spending and what has that profile been, I'd be happy to have that conversation. I'm not prepared to do it today, but I'd be happy to do it.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate it. Dr. King, I'd like to ask about a couple different issues. First of all, with the ISRS support, I know the governor, I believe, had a recommendation of $8 million, and so I'm just wondering, what is the absolute amount you all need in order to keep that process going? If you're only given the $8 million, what are you going to do? And is some of that then going to have to fall on the individual campuses if there's a shortage of money there from the state?
Vice Chancellor King.
Madam Chair, Representative Lean, thank you. This has been kind of a journey for us. We started with the legislature last biennium with a proposal for what we called a 50-50 finance plan that contemplated state support for about $12.5 million a year, and then the campus and system office resources would provide the other $12.5 million a year. With your support, we received $4 million a year from the legislature this biennium in the base. And then we came back in the supplemental season and talked more about it. And at that time, we had a request that sought to come to the 50-50 proposal That did not proceed last session. And so this year we brought you a proposal that would have enabled us to not turn to the campuses or the system for support and instead ask your support for what would have amounted to $25 million a year, which is the requirement we have to move the project forward over the next 4 to 6 years. The governor's support is very helpful. It's very appreciated. And we're hoping that we can similarly see support here in the House. This, as you know, you've had several very good engagements about this project with the project leadership. It's a mission-critical project for us from an enterprise risk standpoint and from a student services standpoint. What I would expect to happen is that we'll come to the end of the legislative session and we'll talk to the board about how to finance the work. And as I heard Commissioner Olson say yesterday, the governor views his number here as a down payment. And I would expect that we would come back to you next year to continue a conversation about how to finance the work. We would proceed, at least the board's current position is we will proceed this summer with something, and we would finance it while we continue to work with the legislature for the resources.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then I'm going to make an assumption that if that full 25 is not funded this year, that some of it would... At least that would be an option that the board would be looking at. Some of it's going to be coming from the campuses then.
Madam Chair, Representative Lean, we would need to put a finance plan together that would enable us to sign contracts. And we would look internally for a finance plan, and we would come back to you next year for a permanent finance plan. But that may, yes, that may well have a consequence that at least for the interim, we would have a system and campus contribution. We think it's important enough to keep the work moving.
Representative Lean.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to jump issues a little bit to talk about tuition and funding to campus support. I'm going to make another assumption that the $169 million number that you had given us to fund inflationary costs at 3%, that if that were funded in full, the system would then be able to implement a tuition freeze for the next 2 years. Is that a correct assumption?
Vice Chancellor King.
Madam Chair, Representative Lean, I'm a little bit at a disadvantage here because we haven't had a board discussion since the governor's recommendations came out. The board's position back in November was a commitment to no undergraduate tuition freezes if the full request was funded. We're now running at less than the full request, and we have not had another board discussion about tuition. So I'm a little bit disadvantaged. I think that's where the direction things are going in, but we have not talked with our board about it.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one more comment. I think it's safe, at least for us right now, to move forward with the understanding that the 169 is what the system would need in order to keep tuition flat for the next 2 years, then at that to be able to fund the 3% inflationary cost for the next 2 years. I'll just leave that as a comment. You can certainly answer to that or not, but
I appreciate that, and I appreciate the line of thinking, Madam Chair. I'm just a little bit without board authority at this juncture to respond to that.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
Representative Fryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my question is on graduation rates and incentives in the campuses for the system as a whole for on-time graduation. Because, you know, if you look at just as a business model, like you said, there's two sources of revenue: tuition and then money from the state. And if a student is taking 5 years or 6 years to graduate, you're actually getting more tuition. And we're talking about also then some of those is actually grants or loans and that from the states or from other sources. So we know that there is an incentive, actually, to have students take longer to graduate or to complete their programs. But what are the incentives then to align so graduation rates are good for campuses and good for the system as a whole, graduation rates that are on time for degrees?
Vice Chancellor.
Madam Chair, Representative Pryor, that's a really terrific question. I don't think there's anybody on our campus that would endorse the idea that they're encouraging longer time to completion. I appreciate the observation that on a purely arithmetic standpoint, but everybody on our campuses work every day to get students to graduation, and there has been tremendous effort put into that in the last 10 years around improving first-year experience, improving advising, improving the way curriculum is delivered, because it's their belief that it's our job to get them graduated. So we have all kinds of efforts going on for that. As to direct incentives in that column, we're not all that big on financial incentives. Part of it is because there's such interest in all of the money leaving St. Paul, so we're limited in the resources we have that we can use for incentive systems. There is a lot of attention between the chancellor and the presidents around performance expectations and reporting results on improving measures. That's certainly an incentive, I think. If I'm a president, I want to have a good performance review. But we don't have anything in the nature of institutional financial incentives that are in place. We have lots of programmatic incentives and lots of strategic incentives, but we don't have financial incentives.
Okay. And we have one last person. Sure. We have one last person on our list to ask questions, and that's Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go back, if you don't mind, please, to the ISRS system. And when I was thinking about the governor's budget with this, quote, down payment, I was wondering, are we losing efficiencies by doing this in a piecemeal way? I think about contracts that, sure, in my professional life I've been able to negotiate. And when you can negotiate a large contract, when you can negotiate timelines, there are often great efficiencies, and things tend to be done in a more cohesive and effective manner. Do you have any comments about that?
Vice Chancellor King.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cleburne, you're exactly right. And as we shared with you when we had the project leadership before you, there's really no way to do this in phases. It's not like you build on an addition on your house and then you come back in a couple of years and redo the kitchen and then you fix the garage. This really has to happen all at once. And so we wouldn't imagine a board action this spring that approved only part of the plan. What we would imagine is a board action that approved the overall project with a finance plan that had some contingencies attached to it. Mm-hmm. So that we could come back next year, so that we could continue to talk about the resources and the balance of resources between state assistance and internal resources.
Representative Cleburne.
So are you, I just want to make sure I'm clear in understanding your answer. So is it more expensive to do it in this manner, or would it be less expensive to do it in a more cohesive manner?
Madam Chair, Representative Cleburne, I'm sorry I didn't
well,
answer your question the first time. It would be much more expensive to do it in phases.
Okay.
If it could even be done. Because this is our entire operating environment, whatever isn't transitioned to the new product has to be kept alive and maintained. And we have duplicate records and duplicate interfaces. There's no strategy for doing this in phases that doesn't bring enormous risk to the enterprise and cost. And so we're just not pursuing that kind of a strategy. This is contemplated as software as a service, which means it's a license for a package of function. It's not the case like in the old days when you just replace the accounting system and everything else stayed as it was. This is a wholesale replacement. And if it were even possible to do it in phases, the double expense and the risk would be enormous.
And then I have one more.
Representative Cleburne.
And this will be the last I ask. thank you. One of the, in talking to some of the representatives who have real IT experience, I am not one of those people, they asked me, were there plans in place when putting this budget together to make sure that all of the data were well cleaned and scrubbed prior to trying to implement this system?
Madam Chair, President Claiborne, that is a big part of the work that's going on right now.
Okay.
And in the detailed project budget, we have something called a data hub. We've spent the last year building a sort of an agnostic place for all the data to live, so that when the new product is available, we can just put that data in. And our campuses and our departments and all of our users are scrubbing the data before we put it in. We have, I think at last tally, we had about 3 million unique users in the system, because we have records for everyone that ever registered for anything. And so all of that is getting cleaned up before we make the transition.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sure Representative Elkins will be happy that you asked that question. well, thank you very much your testimony today. Do you have any closing remarks you'd like to share?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for your strong target and your strong support for the work of our colleges and universities, and we're available to help you as you come to the finish line.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll take you up on that. Thank you. Hi, welcome back to our committee. We have University of Minnesota here. We'll discuss their proposal, well, the governor's proposal a bit, but more so looking at holistically to the members that questions members have about your budget as we put our budget together. And so I want to welcome Brian Burnett, Vice President for Finance and Operations. Thank you, and welcome to back to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for the opportunity to comment on the governor's revised budget recommendation. I'd also like to note for the committee and welcome two of our Board of Regents members, Regents Rocha and Regent Lucas, here in the audience, joining me here today. I appreciate their interest in this. First, we would like to express our gratitude and thanks to Governor Walz, Lieutenant Governor Flanagan, and Commissioner Olson for their support of the university. We are especially appreciative of the $11.2 million increase the governor recommended in his revised budget last week, and for the original $39.2 million he recommended in February. We'd also like to thank the students, faculty, staff, and advocates across our university system and the state of Minnesota who weighed in over the last few weeks for support of their university. We recognize that the increase the governor recommended last week came at a time when the projected budget surplus has been lowered for the state. It undoubtedly was the result of very difficult decisions by the governor and his team. We feel strongly that the investment he has recommended for the university is an important first step in helping us move the state's policy of once again continuing to support or trying to support two-thirds of higher education's total funding, with one-third from tuition and two-thirds from the state. As you know, the state has moved away from this commitment, and we share your goal of helping achieve a better balance between state appropriation and student costs. Last fall, we submitted a biennial budget request of $87 million to support the core of the university's operations. This request was designed to meet our core needs, maintain the work we do today, and continue to serve Minnesotans through our teaching, for our research, and the outreach. The board believes, as President Kaler does, that we must have a transparent conversation with the legislature about what it takes to maintain and enhance the quality of the education we provide our students, the quality of the research activities, and invest in areas that will help grow Minnesota's current and future economy. While the $51 million will go a long way towards helping the university address our core needs, it remains $36 million below the $87 million we requested. And under this scenario, the university will have to make difficult decisions to implement a balanced budget. This funding level is not sufficient to allow for flattening or freezing of tuition, and it makes it difficult to enhance support services that students rely on, such as academic counseling, mental health services, and other needs for them to be successful. Further, it will be very challenging to provide a cost of living adjustment necessary for our faculty and staff in order to remain competitive with our peer institutions in Wisconsin and Iowa and North Dakota and others across our region and nation. It does also put stress on our campuses and programs that are highly dependent on the state appropriations, such as our campuses in Morris, Crookston, and Duluth. To close a $36 million gap, we would be forced to ask that our board consider resident tuition increases slightly above the 2 to 2.5% originally contemplated in the budget. And this level is just insufficient to freeze tuition, as we've been very clear. We'd have to also internally reallocate, make more cuts than the biennial total of $33 million we were already planning to make to balance the university's budget. And this will result in a loss of staff and faculty positions across the university. That's where we spend, much like the Minnesota State system, the lion's share of our money. This will have a negative impact on service quality and responsiveness to our students and other stakeholders, and in some cases could affect the reputation and ranking of some of our departments across the university. We would also have to reduce planned spending on priority investments that strengthen and enhance programs and services related to support for students, advising in mental health, financial challenges being faced by some of our units that are highly dependent on state appropriations, again, to the Duluth campus, the Morris campus, the veterinary diagnostic laboratory that serves all the state's farmers and ranchers, our extension office that hasn't had an appropriation increase in several years, but yet continues to face higher costs. And the capacity, quite frankly, for us to support students in growing demand areas like STEM education. The gap in funding will force us to delay or eliminate these types of investments, which will stunt our progress in this area. Madam Chair, we are very encouraged by the $304 million target you secured for this committee in the House budget targets released Monday. We are grateful for your advocacy and the advocacy of your staff over these many weeks. We are optimistic your negotiations with the Senate and the Governor will yield a final ongoing funding number that matches our full request. Again, we are very grateful to the Governor, Lieutenant Governor, and Commissioner Olson for their support of the university, and we look forward to working with them and all of you in the weeks ahead. So thank you for the opportunity to be here. Associate Vice President Julie Thomas and I are happy to take any specific questions about the university's request.
All right. Thank you very much. Do we have questions by members? You have one? Okay. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I will also ask you about graduation rates. Often I see reported a six-year graduation rate, saying that's like an on-time graduation rate. Normally we think of a four-year degree as finishing in 4 years. So, in terms of a system, how do you align things so that the rewards are for graduating students in 4 years?
Madam Chair, Representative Pryor, obviously one of the big pieces of aligning is the cost, the true cost to the family or the student of graduating on time, but also it's us providing the classes so that they can complete their program. We have different rates across our five campuses because they serve a different population. But I can share with you our largest, obviously, the Twin Cities campus. The four-year graduation rate hit 71% in the last, which is second in the Big Ten among public universities. I think that's something that the state of Minnesota, you as legislators, can be very proud of. Not 20, 25 years ago, the graduation rate was below 20% for the Twin Cities campus. So that's tremendous progress that's been made over time by folks, not in this room, but a lot of faculty and dedicated staff that have worked with our students, and also the preparation students that are coming to the Twin Cities campus have. It's a lesser four-year degree or four-year at our other campuses, but we continue. Those are scorecard issues that our Board of Regents look at, is that four-year graduation rate at Duluth, at Crookston, at Morris, and at Rochester, along with the Twin Cities. But we totally understand that getting them out in 4 years is, one, of good economic value to the student. Mm-hmm. Two, it also frees up room for another student to come in and take advantage of the education that we offer. So it is very much top of mind for all the leadership on our five campuses.
Thank you. Yep. Representative Vice Chair Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Vice President Burnett. To follow up some more, so we know that the Twin Cities campus is the most competitive to gain entry to, and that so you are taking some of the best students and get to select the best students. The other campuses, what is their four-year graduation rates? And, you know, then again, there's probably, you know, some of those students are probably just as much as need not to spend any more money and finish in 4 years and be out. And do we have the same kind of success rates? At least, and I understand, you know, in the Big Ten, that's comparing apples to apples. Sure. We're talking about our other campuses. There's probably another comparison that's important. And is there a comparison that can tell us about our other campuses?
Mr. Burnett.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. Representative Pryor, obviously the Duluth campus has a different set of peers than the Twin Cities campus. Likewise, Morris, with more public liberal arts schools. We can get you that data. It would not be up there with the Twin Cities numbers, but many of them are growing and moving in the right direction. They're trending up in the right direction. And for a couple of campuses that have actually had some challenges, how do we make investments to make that better? So back to where do we put funds in advising and making sure that students can get through in 4 years? That's absolutely a high priority for where we want to invest funds. But we'll get that data for you. I just don't have it here at my fingertips. But it is they're on par with the peers that we would compare those campuses to. But obviously, we've got different peers for the five campuses that we have because they're all quite different.
Thanks. Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have, as a new legislator, you may recall that when President Kaler came, I asked if the request that he was making at that time was sufficient. Mm-hmm. It felt low to me to begin with. And now today you have mentioned that you were going to do a reallocation of $33 million. And today you called that reallocation cuts, which I think is a better term to use because then people really understand what's happening. Yeah. You are using those dollars in a different way. And since you can only spend a dollar once, those are actual cuts, right? Every yes is a no. As I'm looking at the amount of money that our state is spending in the state grant program, I am asking everyone, how does the state grant program benefit the University of Minnesota student, and what share of those state grants do you believe that you are getting as far as the meeting the needs of your students? So the number I think I was just given, oh no, this was for Minnesota State Colleges, okay. Do you know the financial impact of the state grant program to the University of Minnesota and as a system, whole system?
Mr. Burnett.
Yeah. Madam Chair, we heard the question from Minnesota State, so we were checking it on our
website. You knew I was coming.
So across our system, it's about $45 to $50 million that comes in through our five campuses. There's a little over 55. $55 million, all five campuses, comes to support the university's students in those areas. But what I would share with you is, much like Minnesota State does, we take students that are Pell eligible, right, and you add the Minnesota State grant program, and then we have our promise program for students in certain income categories to help. So we stack that aid. It's a stacking of aid depending on the FAFSA and the students' estimated financial contribution from the family. So there's a combinations, but in a piece inside our tuition is about $55 million that comes from the Minnesota State Grant Program, to answer your question.
Okay. And then when I was looking at the resident undergraduate tuition unpaid in section 6, for those of you who want to follow along, it's in the middle. I see that the University of Minnesota has been doing approximately a 2% increase in tuition, has that been something that's been going on year over year, or how long has that been happening?
Mr.
So,
Burnett.
Yes,
Madam Chair.
Sorry. Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Clemore. This chart that we did show about undergraduate resident tuition rates have been relatively stable. Has been an effort both from the regents and the president, but also this legislature. And in two of those years, had actually given money to the university to keep resident tuition rates flat. So I would say there's a lot of credit for why that it was that flat over the. Really, this is President Kaler's tenure, and the average on the Twin Cities campus really over the last 7 years was about 1.2% on average. So we felt like we've really flattened that cost curve for the residents of Minnesota attending the Twin Cities campus, and actually for our four system campuses in greater Minnesota, it's less than 0.5% over those 6 years on average. So it's been a combination of making reallocations or cuts within our organization, additional tuition revenues that we can gain, but also additional investments from the state of Minnesota.
Okay. One more?
Yeah, Representative Clyburn.
Thank you. So right now you appear to be in the middle of the pack for the Big Ten or the Big 12, however we want to call them. If you receive the money that is proposed in the governor's budget, where do you see yourself in that tuition range?
Mr. Burnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Clyburn, we'll probably stay in the middle of the Big Ten. Candidly, our board has to make a decision about where it feels it needs to be on tuition, and they're very sensitive about the costs for Minnesota residents attending Twin Cities and the other four campuses. I don't see us moving dramatically from the median of the Big Ten among the publics. We have been, and you may have read about this earlier, we have been moving from a policy perspective to the median of the Big Ten for the students from out of state that are in non-reciprocity states. So the board has already voted on a 10% tuition increase for those students from non-reciprocity states that will go into effect, and that's on top of a 12% increase the year before. So we're actually, if you flip the page, we actually have a goal to be in the middle of the Big Ten from a non-resident perspective, just from an equity perspective. If we're going to be middle of the Big Ten in terms of cost for residents, we should be middle of the Big Ten. At least the majority of our board feels that that's important. So we have to work at that, because that can also have detrimental effects on your enrollment. And so we've added recruiters nationally. But it's a balancing act, and it's a balancing act for all public universities in this country about access for your residents versus bringing in really highly qualified students from other states that can help subsidize the Minnesota students. That's what
my,
they do.
My concern, Madam Chair,
Clyburn,
is I'm concerned because when you look at the list and you have Wisconsin, Purdue, Iowa, Nebraska at a considerable, if you will, discount from the University of Minnesota, I want to make sure that we hold our tuition in a good place so that the residents who live in our state have an opportunity to be educated here for a good value, but also remain in our state. So I'm really interested in making sure that we keep our brain trust in Minnesota and keeping the university strong at the same time.
Madam Chair?
Yeah, Mr. Burnett.
Representative Clyburn, I would tell you that I believe our Board of Regents feels exactly the same way you do, and we're very sensitive about that. We want to be the first choice for Minnesota's best students to come to our campuses, and so we're very sensitive about that. And so even if we don't get the request that we had asked, we're going to be very thoughtful. It's not going to be an automatic one-for-one. It's just not going to be. It's just that we're going to have to make some harder choices around compensation for faculty and staff, around investments we'd like to make. Those things are going to have to be dialed back a bit if we don't receive the funds that we asked for. And so while the governor's increase was very helpful to us, it's still a pretty big gap for us to cover when our two sources of unrestricted money, candidly, are tuition and state O&M support.
Right. Thank you, Madam
Yes.
Chair.
Yes, thank you. Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair and Vice President Burnett, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And I was just thinking that over the years I've been on higher education, I don't remember that we've ever, as far as requests go, been able to say, we're going to meet you there, you know. So in a way, I'm sort of apologizing for never ever to really live up to the expectation that the university has as far as their funding needs are concerned. But I think we're getting closer, and I appreciate everything that the board does, the Board of Regents, to make it work. The only comment I had was several presidents ago, I remember so clearly, when he would come before the committee, his favorite expression would be, "We're on the brink." I don't hear that now. So I think the university appears to be in good shape, all things considered. And so I'm glad, hope that we can do as much as we can, you know, as a committee and as a legislature to be a partner. So.
Thank you. Mr. Bennett, do you want to comment?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Nornitz, if I can just comment. I would say we're very realistic about the funding challenges you all face as legislators. We get it. And so that was really why we brought a request that we thought was affordable, doable for you. At the same time, we know we have managers and leaders that have to manage in a more fiscally constrained manner. And we're just that's just the new normal. And so we've got a lot of creative people, but at the end of the day, I think what you expect out of us is to do tremendous research, educate the students in the manner that we do, and do it within the means that you and our students can provide to us in being competitive. So I think it's just a spirit that I see working with the leaders on our campuses and within our colleges, that they know that there are challenges here, and they're going to have to make some tough choices. So we appreciate the tough choices you have to make as well when you put a state budget together.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it was, I think, mentioned that competition-wise, the Twin Cities campus turns away students. What campuses in the system have more applicants than slots?
Mr. Burnett.
Madam Chair, Representative, the other four campuses have available slots, and while they are continuing to work on their enrollment challenges, our acceptance rate is roughly about 50% on the Twin Cities campus. It's higher on the other four campuses just because of the profile and the different things there. But I would say there's capacity on just about all of our campuses. Rochester is working on a plan as our youngest campus to grow. I mean, it's a pretty small campus down in Rochester, but there's room at Crookston, there's room at Morris, there's room at Duluth for additional students. I mean, it's just a matter of us getting those students to enroll and come take their course of studies with us. So we have opportunities for students to go to Morris, Crookston, and Duluth that might not be able to get into the Twin Cities. And one thing that the Regents and our academic staff has been working on is how do we get those students that maybe are not up to the top to be able to get into the Twin Cities, how do we help them see that a University of Minnesota degree at Morris or at Duluth or Crookston could be a nice alternative for them. So working together, we're working on this system-wide strategic enrollment management plan. So for those that can't get into the Twin Cities, there's another path to a University of Minnesota degree.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I noticed when you said can't get into the Twin Cities, you mentioned three, because my understanding was that Rochester does receive more applicants than slots and therefore, you know, has to turn away. And I thought from discussions with present and candidates for the Regents that there was a going to try and be an effort to where any students that didn't get accepted into one of the campuses would have a letter which would indicate their options for the other campuses. Has that been initiated? What sort of percentage of shifting from one campus to another have you seen?
Mr. Burnett.
Madam Chair, if it's okay, I would like to ask Vice Provost McMaster, who works on this directly, who's sitting right behind me, to come up and address it. What I would say is Rochester, while Dr. McMaster's coming up, Rochester representative is not at their where they were. They've actually been down a little bit in enrollment. So I don't know about them turning people away, and maybe you could comment on that. But I know that we've seen the Rochester's actually trying to come back up in enrollment from a place where they were before. So I don't know about them turning folks away, but my colleague here would.
You could please state your name for the record.
Sure.
And your affiliation.
Robert McMaster, and I'm the Vice Provost and Dean of Undergraduate Education on the Twin Cities campus. Actually, for another week, I'm the Acting Provost. But so the answer to your question is we have two mechanisms to distribute students out to the system campuses. One is when a student applies to the Twin Cities campus, she or he gets a letter saying, would you like to be considered on any of the other campuses? If they respond yes, we then push their application out to Crookston, Morris, Rochester, or Duluth. And there are a percentage of students who do that, and then those students, if they're accepted, will often enroll on those campuses. There's also a mechanism whereby when the Twin Cities denies a student, we send those names to the system campuses who request them, and then those students are considered on the other campuses as well. We also will push out some parts of the wait list on our campus to the system campuses when we're convinced that we've shaped our class on the Twin Cities. We have to be sure that we've landed our class, and then we push the names out. So there are a series of mechanisms to try to make sure that the applications are dispersed through the other campuses as well.
Madam Chair, on that, part of what I'm interested in is not every campus has the same portfolio of offerings, coursework, and then also degrees. And how much intelligence is in the push out to look at they're applying to this college within the Twin Cities campus, or this, you know, and then the intelligence of there's geography, and then there's also, you know, what are they pursuing, you know, plus, you know, maybe if the reason was, you know, some other, you know, academic or, you know, those type of considerations. How intelligent is the system to be able to help match the referral?
Yeah, sure. Chair Bernardi
ahead,
and Representative, I was glad to hear you mention geography. I'm a geography professor, so that works well. The way that works is that the system campuses will then determine who they think are admissible. So, for instance, if it's an engineering student who's applied to the Twin Cities campus and they're denied, that application will be sent along with all the others to, let's say, Morris, where Morris can say, well, the student said engineering, but they might be interested in the environment, they might be interested in another area, and try to pursue that student. Or it may be that the student has said, I want to be a mechanical engineer and nothing else, and then it's unlikely we would push that student's name out to a campus that didn't have engineering or didn't have agriculture. So there is a bit of a mission match that goes on in the process.
Madam Chair, what is the quantity of students in the last few years that have been shifted?
Chair Bernardi.
In a positive way, we're talking about shifting students.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Mr. Master.
Chair Bernardi and Representative. I don't have that number in the top of my head. It's not a large number of students who take advantage of Share My App, or if their application is shifted to a system campus, will take advantage of that, because often by that point in time, they've made up their mind to go someplace else. But sometimes they will accept admission at the other campuses. We can certainly get you the numbers, campus by campus, on the number of applications that are accepted with this process.
And then, Madam Chair, relational to that is
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the you've got two things deciding, you know, where you're going to expand or contract. Offerings and sections and courses, etc. You know, one is demand of incoming, the other is demand from, you know, employers and the job market. Do you have any discussion of how you have utilized that rebalancing, plus maybe looking at having some joint, you know, distance learning on other campuses to expand their offering and portfolio?
Provost McMaster.
Yes, Chair Bernardi and Representative. We do, in fact, look carefully at workforce needs. An example of this is the enrollment plan for the Twin Cities campus, where a decision was made 3 or 4 years ago to expand the number of slots we have in STEM, as well as in the Carlson School of Management, as well as in agriculture and CFANS. So we're growing our campus enrollment by about 3,000 students to accommodate the need in engineering, the environment, agriculture, business. There's also a very strong online set of programs at Crookston. And so Crookston is very mindful of workforce needs and has developed certain programs to tap into that. I think online is a place that the university probably needs to extend its capacity further.
Representative Cromer, are you finished?
I want a clarification on a line of information.
Sure. If we have other members on the list, so if we could wrap up. Yeah, thank you.
Fairly short. By distance learning, what I was looking at is some decades ago, several large corporations had equipment so they could have televised and distance learning with classes that were going on at Twin Cities campus. Sure. I was wondering if there has been the utilization in order to offer additional coursework at the different campuses and fill out some areas. You know, they might have three here, four there, but you have enough critical mass. If you have a distance learning class, it's not an online class because they would be on campus, but just a different campus site. Is there any information enlightenment you could give there?
Provost
sure.
McMaster.
Chair Bernardi and Representative. There are a few examples of that. One would be nursing between the Twin Cities and Rochester, where through ITV, the Twin Cities does offer courses on the Rochester campus where they don't have the expertise or the resources to do that. So it's relatively limited in niche areas, and I could probably come up with some additional examples, but there are a few nodes where that is occurring.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We have two more members on the list, but I want to add something right before that. I got a statistic from the University of Minnesota about a week or two ago, and thought members might be interested in it. 71% of University of Minnesota undergrads enrolled system-wide are Minnesota residents. If all the Minnesota resident students we admit, the University of Minnesota admits, also enrolled, the number would increase to 81%, but not all Minnesota students we admit decide to come to the university. So I just wanted to share that statistic with you that I thought was a pretty interesting statistic. So Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Burnett, in your opening comments, I was looking at some other information, but I thought I heard you reference there was an additional $30 million or around there of reallocations. Well, first of all, was that correct? Did I hear you correct?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Burnett.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative, as part of putting our plan together, and we've been doing this for quite some time, we plan on a level of reallocation or cuts within our units to help fund cost increases. And over the biennium, as we were doing our budget planning with what we submitted to you, we were planning around $33 million for each of the next two fiscal years. That was in our planning number. And what I said was, if we don't get the $87 million, that number might have to go up, or we're going to have to reduce expenses in another way, because the one thing we will do is balance this budget. We will balance our operating budget year over year. And so those are the kinds of choices. But we were coming in with a very modest, what we felt was a modest, affordable request. But please know that we were going to be making cuts within our units in addition to the additional state investment we've been requesting.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is that money then included with the $90 million that you had planned over these 6 years, or is that additional money on top of the 90, and how much additional on top of the 90?
Mr. Burnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's on top of the $87 million that we asked for. So to do a 2.5% or 2.25% comp pool across our workforce, the size of the University of Minnesota, it's a big number to make. It's a big number to hit. And so we need that $87 million plus the internal reallocations we're going to do and potentially a tuition increase to put that whole package together to do the investments, to give the compensation increases we'd like to do. So it's additive to the $87 million.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, that means you're done?
I'm still going.
Oh, you're still going? Okay, Representative
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I was referring not to your budget requests, but to the $90 million in reallocations that you've been undergoing over the last 6 years. Is that included in that $90 million, or is it on top of it, and how much more is it on top of the $90
million? Mr. Burnett.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi, and I apologize for misunderstanding your question. That's on top of the 90 we've already done. So it's not, yeah, that's 90 plus another 30 over the next 2 years.
Representative Lee?
Thank you, Madam Chair, yes. Okay. Well, that makes sense then. Thank you for that clarification. Now, I have a note here. It's my own note, so I apologize if it's inaccurate. But when the university was in presenting on its budget and its request earlier, I had a note here that it's $87 million for the biennial request and then plus $34 million for tuition. Do you know exactly where that number would be coming from? Am I way off base here?
Okay, and Mr. Burnett, and that request came from us to ask you how much it would cost to do a tuition freeze, I believe. But you can answer the question.
Chair Bernardi, Representative, the $87 million did not contemplate a tuition freeze. Over the biennium, if we wanted to freeze resident tuition on all five campuses, what we said was $27 million plus $87, it would be around $114 in biennial math, would fund our request plus allow us to not move forward with a resident tuition increase that we're looking at around the 2-2.5%, again, subject to the Board of Regents' approval, and that's not been decided at this point.
One more, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. And you can, I'm just going to make a comment here. You can certainly, address it if you like. But it seems to me that if you are asking for the 87 and doing another 30, $30 million, we'll leave it at that, at additional reallocations on top of the $90 million, that you'd be able to hold tuition flat then if you have the $87 million coming from the state, $30 million in additional institutional reallocations that, we're talking about an extra $4 million there, but it, seems to me that we'd be able to hold tuition flat in that case. So, I'd certainly welcome more information, more additional details about that, and we can talk offline, but, again, it's just a comment based on my understanding, and you can certainly address it if you like, but it just seems that with these dollars we're talking about, we'd be able to hold tuition flat. So, thank you.
Okay.
We can certainly talk with Representative Bernardi. We're happy to talk with you offline about the math.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Burnett. Okay, and we have a very eager representative that wants to ask a question. No, he's been wondering where he's been on the list. So I apologize for outing you here. But I
don't
just
know if eager is the word.
Right, but he's...
I just want to ask a question.
Yeah, right, exactly. So Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Vice President Burnett. Had a visit with you earlier, and I value your honest, straightforward answers, and you're doing the same today, so thank you. Also, early in your comments, you mentioned having quality staff helps to make a quality product, and I, as a member, I support that very much and value our staff, and I think that is a very important component in being successful. It's no secret to people here. My son just went through, but, it's amazing the professors that are just in that one area, and students want to come here worldwide just to be, and I'm sure that's the case in every, all the different areas. But anyways, that being what it is. I do have a question, and it's, and I don't know, it's not necessarily to you, but it's a whole operation. But it, so when a student gets accepted, they need to, there's a fee. And it's like $280, $278 or something to say, hey, the U says we like you, we want you to come, and then it's going to cost them $280 to accept that. So I'm just envisioning there must be a way that we could work around, or some rich person that could fund that, Representative David's or something. But it just seems like it's just kind of sad. I imagine being a family that's struggling, trying to step out of where they're at maybe, and to pay for the $280, that's out of their pocket. That's before, they know what their grants are or anything. Has there been effort to work on that? I guess so that's my question.
Mr. Burnett.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. And if, with your permission, I'd like to turn over to Vice Provost McMaster, the Dean of Undergraduate Education, about the matriculation fee, I think is what you're talking about. But
Madam Chair, I don't know what the fancy name is, but that sounds good.
Vice Provost McMaster.
Yes, Chair Bernardi and Representative, there are a series of fees, actually. One is the application fee. That's, I think, $60 or so. The other is the confirm fee, which is $260, $280. With the application fee, we will waive that for students who are low income in the application process, and so they have to document that, so there is a bit of a break there. For the confirm fee, that's actually built into our budget models and helps support our orientation first year programs, and so their budget in large part is based on that fee. The other aspect of this is, although the fee seems a bit high, when we confirm a student, we want to make sure they're going to come. And a higher fee, and I think that fee is not out of line with our other Big Ten, Big 14 colleagues, is pretty much on par with that. And so if it was very low, it would be very easy for a student over the summer to say, well, that was $60, so I'm going to go to Wisconsin instead. When you pony up $280, it's a bit less likely that you're not going to come to the institution.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much. I appreciate your honest answers that we're getting. But I'm just envisioning like a poor family or a family that's struggling, and how do they, and I get what you're trying to do, lock them in, and, but I hope you can consider. I know you said you're doing that on the other one, but there must be a way we could take it out of Mr. Rocher's pay or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. Seems like we could figure out something. Thank you. I have one other question. I'm curious are you making money at the on beer yet at the Gopher football stadium?
Mr. Burnett.
Madam Chair, Representative,
and how much?
We're starting to turn net revenue after investments in the infrastructure, which the Vikings actually helped us with that when they borrowed our stadium for a couple of years. But we are starting to make some net revenue there. And candidly, it's the other Big Ten schools are looking at it. I was queried by several of them. It has cut down on pre-game binge drinking in the parking lots, and it's actually reduced our alcohol ejections over the last 5 years are actually down to an all-time low now. Might be a little bit attendance-based as well, but so far, and we don't have beer sold near the student section, so they've got to make an effort to get it. But it's been very popular with our fans, and so far it's actually been, from a police perspective, a good thing and less of an impact than we ever thought.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you both.
Thank you. We have two more members on the list, and I prefer the big ice cream cones at the Gopher basketball games. That's my preference. Okay, so Representative Cleaver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just going to ask you to just endure these questions from me. When Representative Nornes said, we, the legislature, and while I wasn't part of the body at the time, said he could not recall us fulfilling your requests. So I went through this book very carefully, as you might imagine. And I ran out of fingers with pages to mark for today, but so when I look at your bonding request in the very back, right before tab 9, those have always been inadequate, it's like half, you've received half of what you've requested. As a new legislator, one of the things that startled me was how much deferred maintenance there is, not only on your campuses, but on the Minnesota State campuses. No one is talking about that as a plan. And I'm looking at this $4.5 billion over the next 10 years. I thought Representative Lean was going there when he was asking about the reallocation. I can't remember exactly the large number that President Kaler gave us for the 10-year period, but it was more than the $14 million in 2017, the $33 million that you have planned now, or the $90 million even that Representative Lean mentioned. These are staggering numbers. We are talking about our flagship institution and system. Exactly how deep are we going to go into the real structure with cuts and letting teachers go and cutting curriculum and letting our buildings rot before we have an honest conversation? I'm talking about a real honest conversation about how much it costs to run a high-quality institution and give students the value that they pay for without asking our students to give away their future income for decades. We need to have that real honest conversation. And I'm hearing a lot of nice, and this is Minnesota nice, I get that. But we're not talking about real needs. And if we're going to set real budgets with real strategic plans, we have to be willing to say, this needs to be addressed. And I'm inviting you to that conversation offline or whenever. But these are real numbers, the Minnesota State system, the Minnesota University of Minnesota system. We have to say, here is the big picture. How are we together going to sustain the systems that people before us did really invest in and they sacrificed for? We owe it to the past, and we certainly owe it to the future, and just shoveling more and more debt onto our students is not the way to do it. So I'm asking for that honest conversation, and with that, I'll give up my time. Thank you.
Mr. Burnett.
Chair Bernardi and Representative Cleghorn and members, we would agree that it's a big challenge, and it's why we didn't bring you any new buildings in our capital bonding request. We brought you take care of what we have, which is very similar to our operating budget request. Is we asked for $200 million in HEPR as our top priority. We've never received anywhere near $200 million in HEPR, but we promise you we could put it to work across all four campuses that have HEPR needs. Rochester, we don't own any buildings, so it's the four campuses plus our research and outreach centers across the state. I do think we have to have an honest conversation. This actually came up in the Senate Hiring Committee hearings earlier this session as well. And we're going to have to look at some different strategies here. But we did not bring you any new buildings through the region's approval process. We brought you a reconfiguration for the Institute for Child Development, a rehab of the A.B. Anderson building at Duluth, and $200 million to take care of our buildings because we think we should prioritize the investments that have already been made in our five campuses. And so we agree with you, but you could give us $450 million a year, and we could catch up in 10 years, but our request, we were trying to also fit something that was affordable and, you know, you would take seriously. So that's why we didn't bring forth a $450 or $500 million request. But there's no question, we have catch-up to do, and I think that's very true for Minnesota State as well.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And I hope members don't mind. I would like Representative Rumbeck to be able to ask her question. We're going over, so if you do have to leave, go ahead, but I would really like to make sure we get all our members' questions
asked. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam
questions
Chair.
Questions members have asked.
In your discussion about reallocating funds, I mean, I'm looking at the detail, and it's all where you're cutting. And I've understood that you were going to be expanding the science and engineering area. So perhaps it's not reflected where you're going to be adding. Here you're just showing in the booklet what's being cut back a bit. Where do we find out how you're spending, I guess, once you've done that?
Mr. Burnett.
Madam Chair, we would be happy to report back to this committee and you personally about where part of it depends on where does our budget stand come July 1, right? What does the state appropriation look like? What does our board decide on tuition? We have a plan to expand the College of Science and Engineering and bring in more students to the college. We have tremendous demand there. Right. And we've done one strategy this year with a fee similar to the Carlson surcharge fee, which will add more slots, but it'll be done without additional university or state help. But it's a way to get more students into the College of Science and Engineering. We would be glad to report on that. We would love to expand the College of Science and Engineering. It just takes more recurring money to put the faculty in the classroom, in the laboratories to turn out the engineers of the quality that we turn out at this university. So we'd be happy to tell you where the investments go once we know the number.
Thank you. Do you have any closing remarks? Oh, just a minute. I had a question, but I'm not going to ask it all. I'm just going to make sure Minnesota State hears this question, too, as well as the University of Minnesota. One thing I wanted to know, in the overall budget that you had proposed, if there, because I heard mental health, you mentioned mental health, are there things, we can do this later, you know, one-on-one or whatever, but are there things in there that you're planning on spending or expanding or that provide better service? I'd like to know what those are, because it's nice for the public to know where their dollars are going to if there's other things, expansion or other services being offered.
Okay. Then, Bernardi, quickly, I can just tell you, yes, on our list of potential investments are enhancing mental health services on all five of the campuses. It's been a very strong ask of our student body, of the Board of Regents, of President Kaler. It's very high on our priority list. Again, it's a resource question, but it's very high on our list, and we'd be happy to share with you what those numbers look like.
Okay, thank you very much.
And I would just say, if you, with respect to the closing comments, again, we're very appreciative to you, to this committee, your staff, for the strong support of the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota State System. We do believe we are the in part the economic engine of the state of Minnesota when we turn out the fabulous graduates we have that work in our clinics, our hospitals, 3M, General Mills. I mean, our graduates in every business in this state, and same is true for Minnesota State. So we think we're a great investment. We think we're a great return on your tax dollar investment, and we appreciate the opportunity to share this with you today.
Great. Thank you very much for being here today. Okay. And our meeting is adjourned.